Is there something about this time period that just isn't working for you? Wouldn't you love to go back in time and do something to fix things? Like the apocalypse? Or maybe to stop your parents from making an absolute mess of everything? Sounds like the perfect time for episode 26 of Pop Art, the podcast where my guest chooses a movie from popular culture, and I'll select a film from the more art classic side of cinema with a connection to it. I am your Rhodes, where we're going, we don't need Rhodes, host Howard Kasner. For my listeners, please like, follow, or comment. I'm especially looking for more reviews on iTunes. Today, my guest is writing coach, trainer, and narratologist Dmitry Vorontsov. Dmitry has chosen the immensely popular time travel movie from filmmaker Robert Zemeckis, Back to the Future, and I chose the experimental art film La Jetée from avant-garde French filmmaker Chris Marker. And Dmitry, tell us something about yourself.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me on this podcast, Howard. I'm thrilled to be here and, frankly, quite flattered. My name is Dmitry Vorontsov, and I indeed am a narratologist, which means that I study stories and try to figure out how and why they work. And then every now and then I share what I learned with a few students. Usually they are filmmakers or screenwriters. Many of them work with me on many projects and often stay with me for a year or two or sometimes longer. There have been some movies produced during the time when I've been teaching. A lot of the things that I teach went into these movies. I consider myself successful in what I do. I think that I made a difference in how they make those movies.
Great. Well, with that, let's get to your selection, Back to the Future. First, some information about the film. Back to the Future was released in 1985. It was directed by Robert Zemeckis and written by Zemeckis and Bob Gale. It stars Michael J. Fox, Christopher Lloyd, Leah Thompson, Crispin Glover, Thomas F. Wilson, Claudia Wells, Mark McClure, Wendy Jo Sperber, George DeCinzo, James Tolkien, Casey Sismasco, Billy Zane, Harry Walters Jr., and Donald Fullilove. The basic premise revolves around a 17-year-old who is stuck with and let down by his dysfunctional and slacker family. But when his best friend, an eccentric scientist, turns a DeLorean into a time machine, and the teen inadvertently ends up going back in time or be killed by Libyan terrorists, don't ask, he accidentally ends up preventing his future parents from getting together. Now he has to find a way to make sure they go to the prom, while the scientist's younger self must figure out a way to send the teen back to the future before our hero ends up never having been born. Why did you choose this film?
To be honest, Howard, it was not easy because it would be probably much easier for me to choose a art house movie. When I was racking my brain trying to figure out which of the popular movies to choose, I was thinking which movies gives me the happiest feelings. And this one was one of those. My own personal story associated with this film is rather fun, and I thought that it would be a fun thing to talk about.
I would certainly agree with you in saying that it's a feel-good movie that gives feel-good movies a good name.
Absolutely.
When did you first see it?
As I said, I had a rather fun story about it. I saw Back to the Future Part 2 before I had a chance to see Back to the Future Part 1. It happened sometime around 1989, shortly after the movie came out. You may imagine watching the second movie first is probably one of the weirdest way to get familiar with the Back to the Future franchise. The second movie is based around the events of the first movie. Ideally, you would have to know what the hell happened in the first movie before you watch the second one, but no such luck. And that was in a faraway Siberian city called Novosibirsk. That's a huge city. It's a very scientific city.
Are you from Siberia?
Yeah, that's where I am from. It was winter, which sometimes goes to something below 40 centigrade or minus 50 centigrade. Watching beautiful sunny America during that cold winter times was a happy experience all by itself, especially considering that it was a really crazy science fiction movie, which I had to figure out with no frame of reference of what the hell these people are and what is going on there. So I went there with a friend of mine. We both then were musicians. I was studying music in college, and so was he. That film was a pirated copy. I don't think it was licensed to show in the Soviet Union back then. You know, there were a lot of video lounges, I guess, video clubs all over Russia where people would just gather together and watch some American films. You have to pay money, like in a movie theater. Both came out of that film thinking that, unbelievably, there are some really avant-garde mainstream American movies with such a crazy story, which is really difficult to decipher. Buddy told me that this is one of the most insane science fiction movies he'd ever seen. That was Back to the Future Part Part 2. Only a few months later, I managed to go and see Back to the Future Part 1. And I went to see that film with my father. That probably is also a little unusual way of watching Back to the Future, considering that the story is about a cool son trying to help out the teenage version of his nerdy father to become less nerdy. I invited my father because I expected an intellectual movie experience similar to the second part of the film. And we both had a lot of fun realizing that it's a perfectly mainstream story. A lot of things that I remembered from Part 2 became very clear to me. That peculiar way of watching that film really is one of the most memorable things that happened to me as far as my movie-going experience is concerned. The other thing is that in my family, it was my father who was the cool one, and I was the nerdy guy. It was funny to see the opposite dynamic on the screen and looking every now and then at my father, exchanging glances and laughing.
It's interesting that you say that you saw it with your father and your reaction to it, because the story is based upon an idea by Bob Gale, who co-wrote it with Robert Zemeckis. And it came about because he went home to visit his father. He was going through the attic, came upon his father's high school yearbook, and discovered something he had never known, that his father was actually the president of the senior class. Bob Gale realized he didn't even really know or have anything to do with the president of his senior class, and began to wonder that it ended up back in time. Or if he had been there when his father was in high school, would he have ever been friends with his father?
That's probably a question anybody would ask, and that's something pretty intriguing. Would I be friends with my father if we were the same age? I guess I would. We would share common interests, and that's how we ended up in the movie theater together on that night. I would say that he would be my mentor, even we were the same age, and he would be my peer.
What did you think about the movie upon seeing it again?
I see how it's structured. Since I'm working on the inner workings of the story, since I'm studying the machinery of the story professionally, I was intrigued by how interesting the structure is and how unlike the 21st century idea, the post-Save the Cat idea of story structure, is the structure of Back to the Future. I was also intrigued by the themes of the story. There are subtle and unusual things there that people usually ignore when they watch the movie, but I think that probably to the creators of the story, these were the most important things. I guess I would ask you as an American, what do you think is the attraction of the American audience or worldwide audience? Why do you think it became popular?
First of all, I'll start with talking about when I first saw it, which was under completely different circumstances than you, of course. I simply went and saw it at the movie theater. It was a lot of fun. One of the things that it has that a lot of conservatives today don't like, but I think is one of the things that very much appeals to at least the American audience, is kids always think they know better than their parents. If they had the chance, they could fix things and do a better job than their parents did. Here's this perfect fantasy of actually being able to do that. This teenager who's disappointed his parents. This is all his parents are now. His mother is an alcoholic. His father is bullied. His brother works at a fast food restaurant. He's the only one who has any real aspersions beyond that. The typical, I'm going to be a rock star type teenage dream. And here he gets to do the one thing that almost every child would love to do, go back and correct his parents' mistakes. It also, though it was a little criticized at the time for just toying with it, it sort of deals with incest and the Oedipus complex of finding yourself attracted sexually to your mother, which is why Disney eventually decided not to finance the film. It's also just a very well-made film. Technically, the U.S. has always traditionally had the greatest technical abilities in making film and making all art. So it's also just a technically superior film in many ways. Does that answer some of that?
It doesn't. Actually, you told me something that I didn't expect to hear, but it resonated with me because I do think that most of successful movies are in some ways wish fulfillment fantasies. It's very clear that you're absolutely right that this is exactly the kind of wish fulfillment of making the life better and fixing it that this movie probably triggers in the souls and the minds of viewers. And of course, that fantasy is very pleasant. It also, in a way, rational because it's a rational approach. If something is not working, we take action and make it better. It's optimistic. All of that probably is what makes the story so successful. Also, very well targeting its audience. It's a teenage movie, and everything about that movie is all about teenagers and teenagers' aspirations, teenagers' problems, confusion about the future and the relationship with parents, with the family, with friends, with girlfriends, boyfriends, and so on. So all of those themes saturate the movie and are presented in such a nice package and such a shining wrapper. I do find it strange, though, because that movie may not have happened. Robert Zemeckis and Bob Gale Yale were both on the verge of losing their careers only a few years before.
I know that 1941, which they wrote, was a huge flop. They did use cars and I Want to Hold Your Hand.
I believe both of those films, in addition to 1941, were also rather unsuccessful in the box office. So these two guys had already the reputation of being...
Right, of not being able to create a film that makes money.
They were consistently praised by critics. They were ignored by audiences pretty much. They were a little bit too wild. They probably were having a little too much fun with what they did.
That's a good observation. When I think of those three films, they're doing their own thing and they're having fun doing it. They're not really doing something to necessarily please a wide, massive audience. This is just something they find fun and they're going to make it as fun as they can.
Based on what I read a little bit in preparation to this podcast, I was surprised to find out that Back to the Future existed as a project since probably about 1980 or 1981. It was bounced back and forth between the studios and nobody really wanted it. They went to Steven Spielberg with the screenplay and he wanted to produce it, but they pulled back because they did not want to be known as the guys who can only make a movie because Spielberg is their buddy. Right. What it took for them to make that movie is the previous movie, Romancing the Stone.
Was a huge hit.
More mainstream and less insane in its creativity, became immensely successful, at which point they could pull off pretty much anything. That started the second wave of Robert Zemeckis' career as a kind of writer-director who would recently end up in a movie by Charlie Kaufman, I'm Thinking of Ending Things.
It is interesting to note that Robert Zemeckis did indeed direct Romancing the Stone and it was such a hit, but Bob Gale did not write Romancing the Stone.
Yep.
He had to go outside of their partnership and make a successful movie.
Precisely, which makes me suspect that maybe the Gale was the crazier one of the duo.
Robert Zemeckis has gone on to have a very successful career with movies like You Framed Roger Rabbit. If you look at Bob Gale's career as a writer, it has gone nowhere. The vast majority of his films after this are video games based on the Back to the Future or short films based on the Back to the Future. He really hasn't done anything since this trilogy that's of any note.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of your favorite scenes from the movie? What are some of the high points for you?
I'm glad you asked because I was actually thinking about that a lot. And one scene that is probably my absolute favorite is the episode in which Beef Tannen is bullying the father in the very beginning of the movie. The moment when Beef Tannen crashed George McFly's car, when Marty comes back expecting to go out on a date next day. And the first thing he sees is that car has been wrecked. Beef Tannen, played by Thomas F. Wilson, is in the house acting like it's his house. That scene, I never appreciated much when I was much younger and watched this movie for the first time, but when I recently saw that movie again, that scene blew my mind by how great Thomas F. Wilson was. He's awesome. Mm-hmm. He's relaxed. He is in charge. He is playful. He's really an amazing actor, actually.
Bob Gale has said the character to a certain degree is based upon Donald Trump.
Looking back at that movie now, from the time that we know what happened to Donald Trump, certainly adds a whole next layer of fascination with the story, especially considering the sequel, Back to the Future Part 2, and all these anti-utopian things that happened in it. And I guess in many ways we are living that Back to the Future Part 2.
That's a very good observation. Yes, I guess we are. To me, the movie as a whole is so much fun. It's hard for me to pick out any particular scenes, but I do remember the skateboarding scenes when he takes, I can't remember what we used to call them. They're similar to skateboards, but they had a steering mechanism on them. Then he just tore off the steering mechanism and used that as a skateboard. And I thought those were very nostalgic. And of course, the climax of having to get the car to the courthouse, to the clock at the right moment in order to be able to go back to the future.
How popular were skateboards before that movie? Did the popularity of skateboard change as a result of Back to the Future?
I think it did. A lot of big skateboarders said this was one of the movies that they referenced when they say what really got you excited about skateboarding. Michael J. Fox was a big skateboarder in high school. He was one they originally wanted for the movie, but because he was doing Family Ties, and Family Ties wouldn't allow him to take time off because he was too important to the show, and he was the major reason why anybody watched that show, they got Eric Stoltz, and Eric Stoltz couldn't skateboard. It also became clear that he was not right for the role. He wasn't a comedian. He was a dramatic actor. He was taking it apparently far too seriously. Finally, they went back and made a deal with Family Ties so that Michael J. Fox could take over the role. While Michael J. Fox was filming Family Ties during the day, Monday through Friday. He would then go and film Back to the Future at night and on weekends. And he said it was an absolutely horrible time for him from that perspective, but he really wanted that film. But he said that in high school, he was a lot like Marty McFly. All he was interested in was skateboarding, music, and girls.
Speaking of music, another scene that I absolutely loved and actually put it into practice was where Marty McFly plays Johnny B. Goode, sings it and plays the guitar and goes all crazy and improvises. That scene made a huge impression on me, and I swore to myself that one day I would actually find a way to recreate it in person. I studied in the Conservatory of Music then. I got a chance to play at a concert for some big and important government officials. They rolled out a Steinway. It was my dream to play the Steinway. It was very rare. I was supposed to play some Chopin or something else, and I decided to prank them, and instead I did a good impersonation of, not of Marty McFly, but of Jerry Lee Lewis on the piano. I did do a pretty good job, even if I do say so myself, because I shocked the hell out of them with Sandy and with jumping on the chair, and then I did a backflip at the end. Our oldest piano professor came backstage and kissed me. She kissed me right on the lips, so it went a little longer than we both expected. For the few months afterwards, we tried to avoid each other in the corridors. A favorite moment of mine that actually became my favorite when I was watching the movie with my father, when the Libyan terrorists, they're about to kill him. They actually shoot at Marty, and then the machine gun doesn't fire. And the Libyan terrorists drop a one-liner. The Libyan terrorist says, "Damn, Soviet machine gun." Hearing that line in a Soviet movie theater resulted in the entire movie theater lying down on the floor laughing, cracking up, because we knew that Soviet-made stuff is usually crap. That probably was the funniest and the highest moment when I watched it.
It's interesting that you bring up the music at the end of the scene. This was actually the most controversial part of the movie, and I even felt it at the time, and other critics did mention it as well. Basically, what it says is that a music form that we attribute to black performers was actually created by a white person.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people took umbrage of that. Certainly not everybody, and certainly not many people. In fact, they were going to cut that scene out, mainly, I think, for time. It's not because they didn't like the scene, but the audience liked it just so much. And it is a very funny joke, but it made me a little uncomfortable. Credit is often given to white people when they really didn't have very much to do with something.
When I watched the movie for the first time, I would not be able to identify the problem with it simply because I was not aware that much of the social problems that American society is experiencing.
Right.
I was in Soviet Union, we had a hell of a lot of other social problems back then. This didn't touch me. But now that I live in the United States, I do understand that it probably was a little tactless, maybe in a way even racist, but I'm sure they didn't intend it to be racist. It was just this casual...
They just thought it was a funny joke, and it is.
I would assume that it was worse back in the 1980s because I recently watched quite a few movies made then, and I am sometimes shocked to see how many things that today would be considered outrageous were allowed to be in those movies.
The screenplay is marvelous, but I do feel like I should point out what some people consider the major plot glitch in the whole movie. Marty is the third child.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, his parents have had two children before him, but Marty is the only one who looks exactly like Calvin.
Right.
And you would wonder why the father didn't say, once Marty reached a certain age, he looks an awful lot like this guy we met in high school who's responsible for us ultimately getting together. Have you been doing something you shouldn't?
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. You know, I wanted to bring heavy guns into the conversation and sort of try to be useful to the listeners professionally. I'm not sure if I will succeed in that, but I wanted to mention a couple of things that I find fascinating about the screenplay, about the structure. Mm-hmm. I consider this movie to be a perfect example of the film which doesn't have the so-called inciting incident, where inciting incident is supposed to be. Traditionally, the inciting incident or the catalyst or call to adventure would be the type of event that would happen somewhere within the first 15 or 20 minutes of the story and would involve the protagonist getting into the main conflict of the story. We have something that I would describe as the inciting incident-like scene, and that's exactly the scene that I described earlier, the scene in which Marty discovers that the car he was going to borrow from his father is irreparably wrecked, and his date is not going to happen. His major diabolical figure is right now in the house, and they're walking around, drinking their beer, and how it's George McFly's fault that he had a wreck. No situation happens in that story around the time that actually triggers the main conflict or puts the main character on some kind of quest. It's a movie in which we cannot identify the proper inciting incident.
I think you have a very good point there. I think there is an inciting incident, but it certainly doesn't come where it normally would. It comes much later. And that's when Marty McFly gets hit by the car.
Absolutely right. And I'm so glad that you named that, because a lot of people would be tempted to say when he goes back to the past, but that's not an inciting incident. That's just the beginning of the actual story. But when Marty gets hit by the car, that is an inciting incident.
It has a very long prologue scene, is what the movie has.
Exactly, exactly. Well, the main story is wrapped into another story, which is not as intense. The story has a prologue and the epilogue. The main story really only starts in the second act.
Right. Yeah, that's a great observation, structural-wise.
The interesting thing about that, why I find this fascinating about Back to the Future, is that this really reveals the main problem of the protagonist. That problem is set up early in the first act. I am fascinated by that because I find the rather unusual parallels between Back to the Future and the ideas from Aristotle and Greek tragedy, and also the ideas of Christianity that could be directly incorporated into this film. Very often when we write screenplays, we look for the fatal flaw of the main character. We look for something that is called hamartia, which is something that makes the character imperfect in a very interesting way. So traditional view of hamartia, as expressed by Aristotle, was that it's a flaw that will destroy the main character by the end of the tragedy. Christian approach to the same term, hamartia, is very different because they see it as the analogy of the original sin, as the original imperfection of all human beings, which can be absolved. It's a Christian approach to drama that we see in most of the mainstream American films, in which people suffer from the kind of imperfection in the beginning of the story, and then they take action and improve themselves and become better at the end. I think Back to the Future is an amazing illustration of this type of hamartia, because Marty McFly seems like really a really cool dude. He's awesome. He plays guitar. He's relaxed. He's uninhibited. But he has a major fatal flaw. His moral problem is the absolute lack of compassion to his suffering father.
Right.
So if we look at the father in the beginning of the story, we can see somebody who is probably a spiritually very gifted person, but he is suffering from a lifelong bullying, lifelong suppression by this diabolical presence in his life, Biff Tannen. We may point out that Clyde does seem to play symptoms of a very mild version of Asperger's syndrome. While being a very creative and kind person, George McFly has been pretty much psychologically destroyed by Biff Tannen. And what happens when Marty McFly witnesses the actual bullying right in front of him? What Marty does is sides with the bully and actually bullies his father for wrecking that very car. So there's absolutely no compassion. So it takes something extraordinary, like going back into the past, into 1995, and recognizing his father as a peer, a teenager just like him, who is going through the kind of teenage problems, only he has it much worse. For Marty to begin to learn that his father is a human being, that to care for his father in return. That, I think, is what makes Back to the Future a great movie, really. Thanks to this compassion, Marty manages to change his father as a person and helps him to become uninhibited, free-spirited, and creatively fulfilled. That makes me cry almost when I'm thinking about it.
I think that's actually kind of a perfect way to bring this part of the discussion to a close. Those are great insights. Very exciting. So with that, here's some more information about the movie. It was budgeted at $19 million, but it made $388.8 million. It was the highest grossing film of 1985. It won the Academy Award for Best Sound Effects Editing. It received 4 Academy Award nominations: Original Screenplay, Sound Effects Editing, Sound, and Best Song for Huey Lewis's The Power of Love. It also received 5 BAFTA nominations, 4 Golden Globe nominations, and in 2007, the Library of Congress selected it for preservation in the National Film Registry. Huey Lewis, who was one of the writers of the song Power of Love, plays one of the judges in the 1985 Battle of the Bands contest.
I think he was the one who says they're just damn too loud, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Yeah, I wouldn't have doubted it. Well, with that, let's get to my selection, and that is La Jetée. La Jetée was released in 1962. It was written and directed by Chris Marker. It stars, and I will probably get the vast majority of these names incorrect, Jean Negroni, Alain Chatelain, Davos Hanich, Jacques Ledoux, and William Klein. The drama begins in Paris after World War III, which has driven everyone underground. Scientists have created a way to travel into a past. A man who is obsessed with the memory he had as a child on the causeway of Orly Airport of a man running who falls is deemed strong enough to make the journey. But can he save mankind, and what is the meaning of the falling man? So what do you think of the pairing of the two films?
I think it's amazing. I think that the pairing could be seen not only as formal, because both movies deal with time travel, but also as thematic as well, because both movies deal with transforming the future by going into the past. So I think that's a perfect choice.
When did you first see the film?
I have a little story about that movie as well. Back in probably about 96 and 97, I had a mentor who introduced to me many interesting art house movies, but I had a falling out with him, and he pretty much decided that we should no longer be in contact with each other. He conducted some public presentations of classical movies, and the very next public presentation of the classical movie that he showed in the intellectual art house movie club back in our city was La Jetée. So La Jetée was the movie that I did not get to watch with him. That was the movie that I felt fascinated with ever since, and I only saw it a few years later, and I was obsessed with watching that film because it was personal for me. That was a movie that I was banned from. I guess I saw it sometime around 1999 for the first time.
What did you think when you first saw it?
I was really impressed by the originality of the way the movie was made, because Chris Marker himself referred to this movie as a photo novel rather than a film. He did not even think of it as a film. It was just a photo novel edited together to resemble a film. My understanding is that it was even first published as a book. So seeing that unique way of filmmaking was eye-opening.
Well, talk some about that. It is an unusual way of making a film. And what is unusual about it?
I do hope that after listening to our podcast, our listeners would watch the movie or re-watch the movie. So I hope I don't make any major spoilers. But as we know, the movie is made out of still photographs with music, narrator voice, and a little additional voice work used as a soundtrack. Only one moment in the movie turns into the actual film proper, in the moment when the woman in the, I guess, pre-culminating moment of the story, she turns to the screen and blinks. The rest of the movie, again, is just still photographs edited together.
And it's about 28 minutes long.
I believe there are several versions of this film, and I saw the 26-minute version and 28-minute version. To be honest, I cannot see that much difference between the two versions.
What did you think about it upon seeing it again?
I found it, surprisingly, a little bit annoying. I'll be very sincere about that. I found it slightly too manieristic, and would you forgive me if I say I found it too French?
I'm just laughing because I can't argue with that. I think that may be a perfect way to describe it.
Exactly. Well, I'll tell you what I mean. I do think that the French art house movies or French intellectual cinema has this very stylish way of delivering drama and delivering information. And sometimes style exceeds the drama. And I think that's the general problem of French films, even the best of the French films. And I do think that a little bit of this problem exists in La Jetée. Honestly, I would edit it down to about 15 minutes and I've had my way with it, but I probably shouldn't have my way with it. I think it's okay. It's perfect in its own way.
I first saw it. I can't exactly remember when. I don't know if I was in high school. The local PBS station had started showing art films. And this was at a time when I was trying to expand my view of cinema, because in many ways up to then, my view of cinema tended to be going to the kids' matinee on Saturday, where they tended to show Hammer horror films, Japanese monster films, or sword and sandal films from Italy, and then opening up and starting to see more adult fare at the movie theaters. But this was a relatively small town, Corpus Christi, so we got the bigger films. But I was starting to expand what cinema was and what I saw. So when PBS started showing these films, I saw Jules and Jim, and I remember seeing Metropolis. I'm not sure now what else I saw, and I saw La Jetée, and I was quite taken by it because I'd never seen a movie like it. It was totally original. It was totally unique. As you say, it's just made up of still photographs with a narrator. And I did get caught up in the story, and I did find it actually ultimately very moving with the ending, I suppose you might say, the twist ending. But it was just a very unusual movie. And I still find it very intriguing and very interesting. I do take what you mean when you say you might cut it down to 15 minutes. I'm not sure if this could have gone on much longer than 28 minutes. One of the differences between The 12 Monkeys, which is this movie Terry Gilliam made based on this movie, is that the man going into the past in La Jetée causes nothing to happen. He does cause something to happen when he goes in the future, but when he goes into the past, he doesn't change anything. He doesn't change what's going to come. He just happens to go back out of a particular time of something that he remembers so incredibly distinctive when he was young. Whereas in 12 Monkeys, his going into the past is integral to the plot. It has everything to do with what happens. I do tend to prefer La Jetée because it's so unusual, it's so unique, it's so different. And 12 Monkeys, to me, though a very enjoyable film, is more of a Hollywood studio film, and I'm not sure it's much more than that. I suppose my favorite scene in this one is when they go to the museum, the Natural Science Museum, and they're looking at the stuffed animals and birds, things like that. That's just a beautiful set of scenes that somehow really affects me. I'm not sure why. I sometimes think all these animals are dead, which they will be in the future after World War III as well. It's almost a foreshadowing of what's to come. What are some of your favorite scenes, or what did stand out for you?
You know, I see this film conceptually, so for me, it's difficult to identify a favorite scene in such a short movie. I would say that I was immediately enamored with the actress, Hélène Châtelain, who's, I would say she's my type. Sadly, Hélène Châtelain, she was a great photographer. I think Chris Marker knew her because they were colleagues. Chris Marker was a photographer, right. And she was as well. Want to have a career where she made movies, documentaries of her own. Unfortunately, sadly, Hélène Châtelain died earlier this year in April, I think, of COVID-19. She was in her 80s. I remember when I watched it, I could see why he went back, because I could see how somebody like that guy would fall in love with a woman like that. She's attractive, she's free-spirited, she's emotionally compelling. The way she moves, the way she looks, even though she's in still photographs, you can visualize her as a living being. The beauty of this film to me, why I think it's a significant work of art, is that I believe there's a deception embedded in this movie, because that woman, that romantic interest of that character, I believe she's a devil in that film. I believe she's what brings about his destruction. So in a way, what I find amazing is that this movie is really influenced by film noir, and directly influenced maybe by Hitchcock, because it shows how an attractive woman in all her innocence brings about the complete destruction, the ruin of the main character, simply because he acts on an impulse of going back to her rather than using this amazing opportunity of being saved by going to the future. So to me, La Jetée is a movie against conservatism. It's a warning against being stuck on one's past. It's a warning against being emotionally attached to the past, the terrible dangers of holding on to those images in the past, our darlings that we cannot get rid of. No, the movie says the proper way of action for this guy would be to go into the future like he had been offered, be saved there by all those marvelous people who offered him salvation. But he chose the past because he was attached to it, and that's what killed him. That's why I cannot separate a single scene, because to me this movie is so conceptual that if I single out a scene, it would not work.
I think you're relating it to film noir is rather intriguing and rather brilliant. And that is true. He is destroyed by his love or his obsession with a woman. And so with that, she becomes a femme fatale. And of course, we all know just how hugely influential film noir was for French filmmakers. One of the perhaps most influential aspects of the French New Wave and what came after that.
And we can see the similarity between that female character and, for example, Patricia Francini from Jean-Luc Godard, Breathless, another famous, super attractive and sexy femme fatale in a film noir type of intellectual cinema that came from France. And we can find many similar characters in that story. So I believe that there's something to be said in seeing her as a negative character or somebody who destroys the protagonist.
Right. Are you a big Chris Marker fan? Have you seen a number of his films?
You know, I should see more of his films, but I haven't. So I would not claim to know his work very well.
They had a retrospective here maybe 10 years ago in LA at the America Cinematheque where I saw La Jetée again, probably at that time for the fourth time. I mean, it's not hard to see La Jetée again and again. It's only 28 minutes. The one I remember most is one called Grin Without a Cat, which is a documentary about the revolutionary movements in the US, Germany, and France, and why there was no revolution eventually. And I found it just absolutely fascinating, mainly because he got his point across without any sort of narration or verbal interpretation. It was all newsreels, it was all interviews, it was all talking to people. At that moment, I understood what had happened, why things ultimately changed to a certain degree, but never really completely changed. We never had a revolution in any of those countries. I also remember Sans Soleil as very interesting. He's just a very interesting documentary filmmaker, often I think because he doesn't really tell you exactly what's going on or tries to. It's hard for me to explain, but he tends to just often present things as they are. But I do like his films very much. I have not seen a lot of them, but I do like them. Though, in many ways, he's one of these filmmakers that I can't seem to want to recommend to any of my friends because they're not into anything that's too far outside of what most movies are, at least in the U.S. They like the studio films, they like superhero films, horror films, genre films, other aspects of film, the aesthetic aspect of film, the philosophical underpinning of films, just doesn't interest them very much. So Chris Marker goes into my list of people where I go, I think he's brilliant. I just can't imagine any of my friends would ever like him. Mm-hmm. I think Godard is one of the greatest filmmakers ever, but I could never show them to my friends because I think they would just go, I don't remotely get this way of filmmaking. And also the same for people like Tarkovsky. I love Tarkovsky. A lot of people love Tarkovsky, but I think my friends would find him mind-numbingly boring.
I hate Tarkovsky. Sorry. I can't stand his movies. We should do a discussion when we describe to each other why we like and hate Tarkovsky. That would be pretty fun.
The strange thing is, I'm not sure I could tell you why I like Tarkovsky. Whenever I try to figure out why I like him, I can't give an explanation. With that, a little bit more information about the film. As I said, it was the basis for Terry Gilliam's The 12 Monkeys. The film theorist Roy Armes has said of him, Marker is unclassifiable because he is unique. The French cinema has its dramatists and its poets, its technicians, and its autobiographers, but only has one true essayist, Chris Marker. It's also one of my top five sci-fi films, along with 2001 A Space Odyssey, Metropolis, Solaris, and Alphaville. There are two versions of it. As you said, there are more. The French language version, which I don't think I've seen, is narrated by Jean Negroni, who is in the film. And the English language version is narrated by James Kirk. I have absolutely no idea who James Kirk is. Before closing out, is there anything else you might want to add about La Jetée or about Back to the Future or about both films?
Yes, I would say that probably this bit should be edited back a little earlier when I'm not sure if you are going to keep the quips about Tarkovsky in there. In any way, I wanted to tell you that I do have a little bit of a grudge against Chris Marker for one specific reason. In the titles of La Jetée, the music to the movie is composed by an English composer named Trevor Duncan. Indeed, it is true, and there are some bits of Trevor Duncan's music playing there, but what he neglected to mention, and that kind of really is personally significant for me, is that he uses a lot more music by a fairly forgotten, unknown Ukrainian composer named Piotr Goncharov. All the beautiful music that sounds almost like Johann Sebastian Bach in La Jetée, that's actually not Trevor Duncan at all, and it's not mentioned in the titles. That music belongs to Piotr Goncharov, who was a church composer. Piotr Goncharov had a very interesting life. He was born in the late 19th century in Russian Empire. He grew up to be a church singer. He studied in St. Petersburg Conservatory under Reinhold Glier. He studied composition, conducting, and in many ways he was kind of like me. He had my kind of life story. During his early 1920s, he lost his vision due to the illness. And even though he was blind throughout the two-thirds of his life, and he lived a very long life, he was born, I believe, in 1888. He died in 1970. He was a very active musician in Ukraine. He founded many important musical groups there, and he conducted in the Kyiv Opera, which is a pretty big and important opera theater in Ukraine and the former Soviet Union. He had a very fulfilling creative life, but what he is mostly famous for is his church music, and specifically this church piece that is now part of Orthodox Christian liturgy called I Bow to Your Cross, O Lord. And that is exactly the piece of music that is being performed in La Jetée without ever being mentioned. So I want to step in here, play the advocate of Piotr Goncharov and mention him as the composer rather than two or three moments that don't even last very long where the composer Trevor Duncan has his music performed.
Wow, that's great information to have.
I think that music is very important in this film because I made a joke about editing it down to 15 minutes, but really one of the reasons why the movie works is because it creates this trance-like effect of slow time. Because of this slow, sublime music that is sounding throughout most of the film, that effect is achieved. So music is very important for the movie, and Chris Marker didn't even mention the composer. What the hell?
Let's start closing out, and I asked you to choose a film or two to go with your choice that might interest our audience.
a lot of movies by Ingmar Bergman, interestingly enough, would be thematically close to Back to the Future. Ingmar Bergman as a screenwriter, as you know, Howard, because you and I share the obsession with Bergman, Ingmar Bergman was obsessed about his relationship with his dad. And specifically, I would single out a couple of films that are probably more popular among movies based on Ingmar Bergman's screenplays, and also most specifically involving in the relationship between father and son. One of those films is Fanny and Alexander, which is very loosely based of the relationship between Ingmar Bergman and his father. And in fact, in that film, father, not a father at all, but a stepfather, the figure of the archbishop or bishop, is based on Bergman's father. And the other film, which is based on pretty much the same material, but creatively reinterpreting it in a very different way, is the Billy Augustus 1992, I believe, movie called The Best Intentions.
Right.
Both of those films were intended as a TV series at first, but then they were edited down, one might say dumbed down for the American market, the two-hour versions of those movies existing. I would recommend the longer five-hour, six-hour versions of both films. Both of those films are relatively mainstream compared to other Bergman's films. The other movie also by Bergman, which is about daughter and mother relationship, which I would recommend, it's a bit of an art house classic, is The Autumn Sonata, 1978, which does deal with the relationship between a nerdy person and a very famous person. In this case, mother is famous and the daughter is inhibited or suppressed by her mother. So there are certain thematic similarities between these films. Obviously, I would recommend also, if you just want to enjoy a good time travel story, I would recommend The Terminator, because it has a lot of very similar motives.
That is very true. Excellent choices. I will go for three films. The first are two time travel movies. The third one is an apocalyptic film. The first one, Time Crimes, is a 2007 Spanish film written and directed by Nacho Vigalondo. And it's about a man who finds a way to go into the past, but he ends up making things worse and worse in the present. So he has to keep going into the past to try to fix things. And the next one is Predestination, which is a 2014 Australian film in which Ethan Hawke is sent back in time by a time agency to prevent unwanted events from happening while chasing an unidentified terrorist. The third film is The Quiet Earth from 1985. It's from New Zealand, directed by Geoff Murphy, about a man who wakes up to find himself to be the only person on Earth. Everyone has disappeared, or so at first he thinks. He does eventually meet two other people, but tensions between the three might mean the world will be left with nobody to inhabit it. Though no credit is given, it's really basically a remake of an early, I can't remember if it's from the 60s or 70s, American film called The World, the Flesh, and the Devil.
Wow, that sounds like something I would want to watch immediately.
One of the most interesting things about The Quiet Earth is when you find out why he's still around. It's a very interesting premise.
Can I throw in a couple of suggestions also based on Legete? One film that, for whatever reason, remains rarely watched in the United States, and it's a shame because it's one of the greatest films that I know, is called Je T'aime, Je T'aime. I Love You, I Love You. It's a 1968 movie by Alain René. Alain René is probably most famous for his film Hiroshima Mon Amour. He was the early collaborator of Chris Marker. They were friends, and they worked together on several documentaries, including a famous Alain René documentary, Night and the Fog. Je T'aime, Je T'aime is a fiction movie that tells the story of scientists experimenting on time travel and handling time travel in much the same way as Chris Marker did in La Jetée. It's also travel inside your mind, into your memories, rather than physical travel through time. So there quite possible had been an influence of La Jetée on Je T'aime, Je T'aime. I would personally say that Je T'aime, Je T'aime may be a greater movie, but in any case, I do think that these two movies are connected and I recommend it. Je T'aime, Je T'aime, in turn, was a great acknowledged influence on Michel Gondry's film Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, which was based on Charlie Kaufman's screenplay. Also, I would very much like to attract the audience's attention to a movie called Suzhou River, directed by a Chinese film director, Lu Ye. Suzhou River is a very interesting, unusual variation on Hitchcock Vertigo. Since Chris Marker was obsessed with Vertigo and somewhat reinterpreted it in La Jetée, it would be interesting to see how elements of La Jetée and elements of Vertigo converge in this Chinese movie.
Great. What is next? What should we be looking for from you?
Thank you very much for asking that. I would very much like to have another podcast like this with you, Howard.
That would be great. That's definite.
What I wanted to mention, and I hope you forgive me for the shameless plug, there are Superstar Screenwriters, which is my business, are proud to announce our first ever screenwriting contest. Officially, it's our first ever. We ran a test contest a year ago. On November 2nd, we are starting the real one, and the applications are now open. It won't be a contest in the traditional sense. It will be a little unusual. It would be an interactive learning contest. You do not come into that contest with the screenplay already written. You create your project while you're taking part in the contest. The way it's done, we will provide a very clear and explicit instructions for every step. We'll guide you through that. And then after you create your best project, you will have a chance to compete against other people who created the project alongside with you.
Do you have a link or a website for that?
I have to send it to you. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I do not have the technology personalized enough to be able to do it inside my website, so I am forced to do that inside a Facebook group instead. People who don't have Facebook, they would not be able to participate, which is unfortunate, but that might be probably the only great reason to sign up for Facebook during this 45 days contest. And somebody is going to win big because there's going to be a cash prize at the end.
Great. Well, as for me, I'll go over my usual litany. I'm a screenwriter and screenplay consultant, so I have a Howard Kastner Facebook consultation page. I have a blog called Rantings and Ravings, in which I talk about issues connected to movies and screenwriting. I published two books of short stories on Amazon, The Starving Artist and Other Stories, and The Five Corporations and One True Religion. These are stories that are sci-fi, supernatural, horror, and fantasy. I published the second edition of my screenwriting book, More Rantings and Ravings of a Screenplay Reader, and I'm an amateur photographer, and you can find those on Instagram. The previous podcast was with critic and writer Hermione Flavia, where we discussed The Running Man and The Most Dangerous Game, two movies about men hunting men for sport. The next episode will be with film producer and editor Drew Hall, where we will discuss Snatch and Mel Brooks' The 12 Chairs, both movies about the desperate and farcical search for missing jewels by a disparate group of people. With that, once again, Dimitri, I want to thank you very much for being on the show.
Thank you very much for having me here and for selecting such wonderful movies.